and welcome to The Smoke Break. I'm your host, your old pal Zane, here with Zoe Schwartz.
Hello.
Taylor Barrett.
What's up?
And Joey Wander.
And Joey works in drug and alcohol counseling with a focus on harm reduction, and that's something we're going to talk about.
Yeah, so glad to have you here. Talk about harm reduction. You use they, them pronouns, correct?
You.
Excellent. All right, well, let's get started. So, harm reduction. I just started working with you. Not just started. We've been working together in the harm reduction field a little bit, but how did you kind of come into it?
Well, I am a person in recovery myself. And I think the thing that drew me to harm reduction the most is just the idea of treating people like human beings, because they are.
What a concept.
Yeah.
It's wild. So novel, yeah.
Vague foreign concept.
Yeah. I think the thing for me, you know, was I spent a long time having people not do that for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's very common for people to treat people who use drugs as lesser than other people. And I, you know, once I started to move away from that, I got to a point where I was like, okay, well, these aren't the things that I want to do anymore, but I still respect people's autonomy too.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's important kind of in the recovery realm of, like, even though you're not currently doing it, it doesn't mean that you now get to look down on people who continue to do it.
Yeah,
definitely.
I've noticed it's been a pretty consistent issue, especially in the field that we work. Like the people that like only smoke weed, getting really uncomfortable and like almost antagonizing people that do other substances that they've deemed to be worse, and more extreme. And the conversation around that has been a difficult one to have because they're so decided.
Well, there's the hierarchy.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing.
Yeah. Like, what are your thoughts on the hierarchy?
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff there, but I mean, as we know, like, there's certain drugs that are like used to, you know, we categorize drugs based on all sorts of things that like helps that hierarchy be built, right? And it upholds lots of other systems that are harmful.
Bad. It's bad for poor people to do crack, but it's okay for rich people to do coke. Like, you
absolutely.
Know. But like, coke is worse than weed. But like, it's so weird the way that we have like, yeah, these systems and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So how was harm reduction helpful in you reaching a point of sobriety?
I mean, I think one of the things that I tell folks when I start meeting with them, one of the first conversations that we'll have. Is I'll basically say, okay, well, I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm not here to tell you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not here to tell you what not to do.
Sure.
I am just here to meet you wherever you are. And if you want to keep engaging with substance use, cool. If you don't, cool. Let's talk about that. And
yeah.
If you do want to continue engaging in substance use, let's talk about ways that you can do that in a way that like maybe you won't die.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and something I really like that you say a lot is like just even using the phrasing of like, if you want to change your relationship with the substance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's such a good way to like to frame that, because I'm not asking you to get sober. I'm not asking you to, you know, quit altogether. It's just like, if you yourself are uncomfortable with your relationship with this substance, like, and that's something you want to change, that's something I want to help accompany.
I've always really appreciated your ability to like navigate a safer relationship with people that plan on continuing to use, because it's been so stigmatized and like just overlooked and like sheltered. There's not a lot of information on it that's easily accessible to people. There's not a lot of like information that's readily there for people to learn how to use it safer, or how to like guarantee that they know what they're getting even. And so like offering like the needle exchange and test strips and everything is been like super vital to building trust with people. And that has enhanced their relationship with you and their ability to like be open and honest with you and have discussions around use and sobriety even, and just all the potentials for it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Zoe, what has been like your experience with like either harm reduction for yourself or just seeing how it plays out for other people?
I mean, I think I kind of like use a harm reduction kind of philosophy like to apply to a lot of different areas of life, because I think one of the biggest things I learned like when trying to make changes in my life that I hoped were going to make me happier, you know, or functioning in a way that I want to be functioning, I think approaching any sort of behavior change from a perspective of harm reduction is a really helpful way, because I think like absolutes or like all or nothing thinking like really is super harmful and often encourages people to go the opposite direction. And so in my experience, even just like with like wanting to do just even something small that might have like, you know, wouldn't even be necessarily considered like a harmful thing that I'm trying to do or not do, but just a behavior change that might help me. Yeah, I think I try to really think about it like, how do I listen to my body? Like, how do I figure out what feels good for me? And I think that's a really much healthier way to like guide us towards health or whatever health looks like for us, you know? And so I think in that way, I think harm reduction can, like, maybe that's not exactly harm reduction, but I feel like the same philosophy behind harm reduction, or maybe it is exactly.
It absolutely it is.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that I come up against a lot is a lot of people, when they hear about harm reduction, they think of only like needle exchanges and programs like that. Something that I try to frame this to people with a lot is that, like, you can have a relationship that is hindering and getting in the way of you and could be considered unhealthy with anything.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I thought, but I wasn't totally sure if I was like over broadening the, or overusing the.
I think it would be important too, like, and also just out of my own curiosity, like, if somebody had no concept of harm reduction and they were just like, what is that? How would you answer that?
It is simply, I mean, it's in the words, right? Like, it is about reducing harm.
Yeah.
You know, whatever that relationship is that you're trying to shift or that you're trying to change or look at differently, how do we look at that and allow you your autonomy to continue doing whatever it is that you want to do in a way that reduces harm as much as possible.
Yeah.
And I really like that you bring up like that idea of, you're watching me do it. Bring up that, I don't know. You bring up that idea of, nope, fucking lost it.
God damn it.
Sometimes.
Well, were you talking about the autonomy?
Go ahead, Zoe, please. Fucking jump in.
I was just gonna say, like, I think about, like, as like someone who, like, you know, helping people with their mental health, you know, or like being someone that people come to for that as a job, like, I think of it in the way that I help people, like, yeah, just like anytime anybody's like, I want to do, I try to be like, hey, if we set a goal this week and you come back next week and didn't do it and you feel crappy, like, I want you to know that, like, I have no judgment about whether you did or didn't do it. What I want to do is I want to talk about why it didn't work and how we can help you work towards your goal and try and find another solution. And I think that's, so I think I honestly really, like, you in my job, that's my main sort of like way I think about helping people make changes. So I guess I am.
Yeah.
I'm a harm reductionist too, I guess.
Yeah, there you go. Hell yeah. Well, and I finally remember what I was going to say. The thing that I liked, I lost it as soon as I said that. The thing that I liked about the autonomy thing is the hindrance part, you know, because it's just like understanding like whether or not something is hindering, right? So it's like you have your goals. And then you look at the substance and you're like almost looking at them separately and until a point where it's just like, okay, if my goal's here and my substance is here, is this coming in between the two? And yeah, like there's definitely times like when I was smoking weed that like, I'm just like, this is helping me with this situation. So it's not hindering me in this sense, but in a different sense, like I have a harder time going out. I have a harder time going to events. I have a harder time staying at events. Like, so creating like a healthy relationship with a substance, I think, is important.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's a large part of the whole thing, right? Like the reason that people do drugs is because they do something, right? Like people
helping
don't
with something.
Yeah. People don't use substances for no reason. Absolutely. Right. And so it's just a matter of looking at like, what are the ways in which this is helping me?
Yeah.
And what are the ways in which maybe this is getting in my way?
Yep.
Right. Like I've talked to people who have intense mental health struggles and maybe deal with like psychosis or non-consensus based reality stuff that they'll be prescribed these like heavy medications. And so then like I remember one kid specifically that I was talking to, one of the most lucid conversations that we ever had. He just kind of randomly came up to me. I was on a break outside and he randomly came up to me and he was like, I don't know what to do. And I was like, what do you mean? What's going on? And he was like, well, I keep smoking meth and I keep ending up in jail because I'm getting caught smoking meth. But it's the only thing that makes my symptoms go away and like makes the voices quiet and like makes me feel like a human being. And like all these medications that they put me on, I just sleep all the time and I feel awful, you know? And so for that person, right. The downsides to smoking meth, which for him were getting thrown in jail. And you know, he had a persistent like cough and some other things that can come up from using certain substances. Those were easier for him to deal with than the side effects of these medications that he was being put on.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. No, I appreciate you saying that. Cause yeah, like there was somebody who I was working with who had expressed that like I didn't even notice that they were like schizophrenic, but they had expressed that like smoking marijuana helped like with those symptoms. Mm-hmm. And like, I was like, oh man, I wish that worked for me. Cause it just makes it worse. I'm just like more, I have more of a psychosis. I'm like, ah, but yeah, I thought that was super interesting because I wouldn't have thought like something like, cause you would think that like, you know, getting in your head wouldn't help you with being in your head, but mm-hmm. like for this person it was.
Yeah.
So I think it's even important too to like understand that like different substances impact different people in different ways.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, I was thinking the same thing with like marijuana. Like, yeah, I feel, or weed, I guess. I'm all why I call it marijuana.
Yeah,
I feel the same way. Yeah. Like I feel this similar, like there's certain things that it really helps with. And then there's other things that sometimes I feel like it holds me back from. And yeah. And it's finding that balance. And I feel like every time I've ever tried to like quit 100%, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, then I just want to do it more, you know? And so I think that's a really good example of like why harm reduction makes more sense. And I also think it's like, it's just like a way of, I really like the idea of it, like teaching you how to be more intuitive about what your body needs, because I think that's something that our culture like takes from us and tells us that we have to look at like outside rules about how to be healthy or how to be well.
Yeah.
And I think like if we all had a better connection with our bodies, which we like because of the way our culture is, we lose that connection a lot. Mm-hmm. I think I like the idea that like it really encourages people to check in with themselves in a way that can be supportive of like all sorts of other things, right? Like being more in tune with ourselves and what's happening in our body and what our body needs in the moment based on how we're feeling, you know, versus like what we should or shouldn't be doing.
And it's really interesting and kind of like wholesome to hear the conversation being around like what this substance is doing for you instead of like working against you. Cause most of the conversations are just around like getting sober period or just like how this is affecting you negatively, right? Or like how like the long term and the short term negatives. But like when you talk to people with like a sense of vulnerability, like your example, like it did something for them. It did something massive for them. It helped them navigate like their psychosis that the medication wasn't doing for them. You know, I've noticed that a lot of medications kind of seem like sedatives where they're just like you can't experience this if you're unconscious, and mm-hmm. they just put you to sleep.
Yep.
So like they acknowledging that like it helped them navigate their psychosis a lot, and the backlash from that was going to jail, and that isn't an autonomous backlash.
It's something happening from the outside.
Exactly. It's a societal thing that is, well, you did the thing that helps you, but I don't like the thing that helps you. So now you need to go to jail.
Yeah.
And that's such an interesting and like frustrating chain of events.
Yeah.
Well, I think it would be wild if like we really knew how much of people's experiences who use drugs are in, like how much of the negative things that we see are because of things like systems like that affect you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
I was just going to say, are they paranoid because they're experiencing paranoia or because there's a system that might be coming after them because they used a substance?
Or both.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
I think a really important thing to remember, too, is like every substance that people develop these attachments to physically, emotionally, mentally, whatever, have all been used at some point for medical purposes.
Absolutely.
Every single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they do something.
Yeah, I remember you bringing up like in the presentation you made about like fentanyl patches being used medically, and I was like, I never even would have thought about that.
Still.
It makes sense because of the massive pain reduction and so like having that conversation from there, knowing that it's a pain reducer, like it makes so much more sense. You know, it's easier to understand why people use a substance when you're acknowledging the positives from it.
Yep, definitely. Yeah. And I think that, you know, like ultimately, like if we can look at a substance and how it's positively impacting somebody, then we can also, if they want to change their relationship with that substance, look at other ways that they can meet that need.
Yeah. So. The needs that they need to be fulfilled that they're seeking in the substances.
Yep. Absolutely.
Something I thought of when you said that is also like you're seeing the person for their experience. Like you said, instead of focusing on the negative, you're like, I see why you're using this. I see how this, and
humanizing.
That way, yeah, you're seeing somebody in their whole experience versus just being like, oh, you're, you know, this person's a drug addict and that's a bad thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's
and the response, if that's the reason why someone is using a substance, right? The response cannot be, you need to stop doing this thing for X, Y, or Z reason. The response has to be, okay, this is the thing that you're trying to mitigate. This is the thing that's helping you do that. how do we allow you to continue to engage with that thing that is helping you
right.
in the least harmful way possible?
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. All right. We're going to take a real quick break and we will be right back with the smoke break. And welcome back to Smoke Break. I'm your host, your old pal, Zay. Here with Zoe Schwartz.
Hello.
Taylor Barrett.
What's up?
And Joey Wander. Yep. All right. Cool. So,
yep.
yep. Yeah. So on this section, I actually wanted to talk about survivor's guilt because I feel like it's a special kind of guilt. I lost one of my best friends when I was 17, which actually led to a lot of my drug use because that person was using substances kind of frequently at the time. And it was like, I was shaming them at the time. Honestly, I just didn't have any more information. So when they passed away, I had like tried like different substances, like prescription pills and stuff like that around that time. And because, you know, I lost them, I was like, oh, this is my way to connect with them. So I was trying to process my own grief while also trying to keep a memory alive. What has been, I guess I'll just ask, what's everybody's experience with like survivor's guilt been? Go ahead.
I mean, I think I have experiences with this in a few different ways.
Sure.
You know, again, I'm a person in recovery. And you know, I've also been houseless, most of my adult life.
Okay.
And so it manifests in a couple different ways of like, you know, just being around the people that I've been around for most of my life. I've lost a lot of friends.
Yep.
And I also am now in recovery and I don't do a lot of the things that I used to do. And I'm also housed and like, I pay my rent by working with houseless youth, you right. know? And so when I got my first job at a drop-in center, I had this moment. I kind of went into a little bit of a depression for the first few weeks where I was just like, what am I doing? Like, why is it that I get to get paid like a living wage and pay my rent and go home at night when these kids have nothing, you know? Yeah. And it's this weird experience because I know what it's like to have nothing.
Yeah.
But I have to remind myself that like any of those folks given that opportunity would take it.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think there's a certain amount of like difficulty that kind of comes with like still being here. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, like that person's life has ended and it's like looking at your own situation and being like, OK, but I have to continue on, you know, and like trying not to feel guilty that like you have this opportunity to continue on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like wanting to honor somebody that you lost that was really close to you, it's part of the grieving process, I would say. And it's part that's like a heavy part of the survivor's guilt is like, how do I honor this person? And that makes a lot of sense why you would start using substances that you had previously been shaming them for using, because you like, that's how you were honoring them. You're like, this mm-hmm. is something that is special to them. So I want to participate in that and like experience this world that was a part of theirs.
Right. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, and I liked the perspective you offered too, Joey, that like not like you're in that example that you gave. I think if I understood correctly, like not necessarily someone who died, but just survivor's guilt around overcoming something that was really challenging and then witnessing people that you still care about or that that are still experiencing this and the guilt around why did I get this opportunity? Yeah. Like I mean, like on a totally different perspective. Yeah. I think like just even having like we all are born into different situations in our lives and realizing how unfair it all is, you know? Yeah. And then, yeah, it's a really, you know, obviously if we have more privilege, it's a totally different experience, but I do think it's just, it's hard to understand why certain people have to struggle with certain things and other people don't. And it is hard when you are able for whatever reason to overcome that challenge, to not feel just really immersed in that, you know, I don't know if it's guilt or whatever, but yeah, I mean, it's survivor's guilt. I guess we said that. But I like that you offered a different perspective that doesn't necessarily have to be around like a death of someone. Yeah. And I think, and I also, it makes me think about like just in general, like how death can shape our experience. Cause like I had some friends die when I had two friends die when I was like right around 17, 18. And similar ways that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, I don't know if I ever described it as guilt, but it just sort of like really shaped my experience and like is a big part of my, like, I don't know, it's a part of my story, you know, was losing these people really young and having the experience of trying to understand why they chose what they chose and, mm-hmm. and you know, whatever was going on in their lives around that. Yeah. I just think, yeah, it's a part of my identity. Well, and so it's different than guilt, but it's still relevant in the sense that like it shaped my experience. It shapes my experience every time I lose someone else or every time I hear about someone choosing to take their own life, you know, or, yeah, or struggling with that.
Well, and I think like the kind of guilt that you kind of end up with is dependent on the way that you lost them. Because like I've had people who have lost people to suicide and they're like, if I'd picked up the phone, if I'd showed up, if I had a friend who, the friend I'm referring to had died in a car crash and one of my friends was hanging out with them before, you know, like they were headed back to town and he was like, man, I should have just told them to stay. I should have, you know what I mean? And I feel like that's a really hard thing. Like after you've lost somebody, is like asking yourself the questions of like, could I have done more? Did you have any experience with that?
Yeah, I think so. I lost my best friend back in 2016. I have this tattoo for him, and he did end his own life. And he was a poly substance user. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know what that means that he would do any drugs. Mm-hmm. He was indiscriminate. He loved doing drugs. We used to use drugs together. And there was a period where, and this is something that moved me, into working in harm reduction in a lot of ways. We had a conversation, when he was, he said that he had given himself an expiration date, mm-hmm, at one point. And so he had intended to only live up to a certain point.
Sure.
And he had passed that point, mm-hmm, long before this. And he had left town and lived alone in the woods for a while. And he came back to Portland and found me and our other best friend and did this thing. It's interesting when you talk about like not noticing certain things,
right?
You know, like knowing what I know now, I recognize like signs that I didn't see at the time, but sure. He, you know, came with a bunch of his possessions and just started like giving them to us and was like, I don't need these things. Do y'all want these things? You know, and then he leaned more, into using substances even more than he did before. And there was a night that we were hanging out. It was late at night. And he was also very smart and knew a lot about chemistry. And he'd spent all of his food stamps, on like, poppy seeds and things to like synthesize basically like liquid opium. And he'd made this like gallon jug of like poppy seed tea that he'd just been drinking on for days. And he just kept making more. And he was like stumbling into traffic. And we had this conversation where I was just like, hey, you know, like I don't ever like judge you for what you do. But I'm worried about you, you know, like you're almost getting hit by a car. It's the middle of the night. We're kind of in the middle of nowhere. And that was the last conversation that we had. And he got mad at me and was like, how dare you judge me? I've never judged you for what you do. And I wasn't able to make that conversation up. And you know, I went from there to sleeping under the bridge next to the river where he jumped, you know. And so I have this moment often where I, you know, I'll feel guilt for that. But what I tell people, you know, I used to run a grief group, and one of the things that I would often tell people is like, feel that. You know, like you have to like feel that and acknowledge that and like name that and like see that for what it is. But then you have to put that shit away.
Yeah.
Because that's not going to do you any good. That's not going to do that person any good.
Yeah.
You know, like I know that he doesn't want me to spend the rest of my life like wallowing in guilt and like depression for like what I could and couldn't have done, because right. Like he made the choices that he made. And that's his. Going back to autonomy,
yeah.
You know, like that, those were his choices. And it's not for me to like feel guilt that I should have stopped him from making the choices that he made.
Definitely. You
know? Totally. Yeah.
Well, and I think that like there's a certain amount of like looking back on stuff and being like, but did I do everything I could with the information I had? And that's a really hard place to get to, because it's just like there's always that like, if I knew this, then I would have. If I knew this, then I would have. If I knew this, then I would have.
If I just would have done something different.
Exactly.
There's a lot of like regret with your own actions to just like, oh, I should have just done something different. But like, there's no way to know that you should have done something different.
Yeah, exactly. So I think like a certain amount of like compassion, like you eventually kind of have to like reach a certain amount of compassion of like, I have all these really good memories with them. Like I tried to show them a good time in the ways that I knew how to. Like, I think just remembering those things fondly and just having that compassion for yourself of like, I couldn't have known everything, therefore I couldn't have done everything. Definitely.
I have a friend who, like one of my friends that I was talking about that passed away, that killed himself. He, like in his suicide note, wrote about one of our friends, and that caused her a lot of survivor's guilt because he, like, you know, had really like big feelings for her, and, you know, and they'd been friends forever, but then also they were using drugs together right before the time he died, you know, and like she maybe felt like she was pressuring him to whatever. Like, so it was this whole thing. And I remember her like really like, I didn't talk to her for a couple of years, and she like got sober and like did all this stuff. And then when I talked to her, finally, she was like, I was like, I don't even believe in religion or anything, but I like thought I was going to hell. Like I had all these like horrible thoughts and feelings about what happened. And I didn't know. It was like, and I knew what had happened, but I didn't know how she had conceptualized it and like how it had changed her and shaped her, you know,
like
it
was, what her grief was like.
Totally. It was really, I mean, we all were grieving. I mean, he was a close friend of all of ours, but you know, and then, I mean, that's complicated too, but like, that's hard for her, but it's also like that was his experience. Yeah, it was just a really complicated situation to go through as a young person. Yeah. But yeah, I remember her telling me that and being like, wow, I didn't realize. But like, I was appreciative of her sharing that experience, you know, just because it really opened my eyes to like, you know, what that would have been like.
Well, and I think it points to like the stories that we create around like somebody passing, you know, it's just like what story are we telling ourselves about that happening? You know, it's like if there's some kind of closure and like, hey, you know, like this was a decision that this person decided to make, like, and if I care about them, then I would want them to be happy. And like, I hope that they are.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that's extremely important, you know, because it's if you live with all of these, like, if I had or what ifs, then it's like you're always going to be upset. And you, at the same time, I think something that's really important to like even mention is that like we think that like by intervening, we could have done more, but there's no proof of that.
Yeah. Totally.
You know, like there's this idea that like, well, if I had been here and done that, you know, it's like, I could have stopped this car crash. There's nothing to say that they wouldn't have driven down the road, a deer would have ran out, and another thing would have happened. You know what I mean? So it's like we really have to just like come to terms with where things are at and understand that, you know, like there's only so much we can do.
It makes me think about how like as humans, we just like want to make sense out of things, you know?
Oh, and absolutely.
I think that's just another example of how this like idea that we have control, but we don't really have control, and we're still, because, you know, if we believe that we have control, then we take accountability for everything. Right. And I think that's another problematic idea in our culture. And I just think that encourages us to want to make sense out of things that aren't ever necessarily going to make sense, or there's never necessarily going to be like what would have, should have happened. And versus, because like the conversation we had last week about when someone chooses to take their own life, like that's a whole other complicated conversation too around autonomy. Right. So I think,
funny because I was going to talk about exactly that.
Oh yeah.
You know, I think, this is something that we have conversations a lot about, in our work, but I've talked a lot about like the writing reflex, right? Which is exactly what you were talking about. Totally. This, like, we have this urge to like, want to like fix things and thinking that we, know or have the power to, fix things and make things right. Right. But when it comes to suicide, that's a difficult thing for people to wrap their brains around, right? Like this concept, like talking about autonomy when it comes to suicide is impossible for a lot of people.
Well, they're like, you can pick your own clothes, but like what do you want to do?
Right.
Yeah.
And I think like a lot of that is wrapped up in like the culture that we live in and like the Western concept of like life being sacred and this, like, there's a lot of like religious ties in there of like people thinking that you know what happens after you die. Like, we don't, you know, and this idea that like ending your life is like a moral failing of some sort. And like, we can't say that. Like, it is not my place to say that for another person, that like their choice to end their life is not like better for them than what they're currently going through. Like, that's your choice. And like, I'm not, like, for me to try to stop that or think that I have the power to stop that.
Yeah.
It is not my place.
Especially like retroactively, like going back and just being like, I should have done this, I should have done that. Like, like, we just like, kind of have to honor them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, excellent. We're going to take a real quick break and we will be right back with the smoke break. And welcome back to The Smoke Break. I'm your host, your old pal Zane, here with Zoe Schwartz.
That's my name. Hi.
Taylor Barrett.
What up?
Joey Wander.
Yellow.
Yellow. It's my favorite color.
No, it's not.
Transition. It's not. I'm wearing all black.
I was going to say, we know what your favorite color is.
Speaking of what I'm wearing this very, it doesn't look like anything, but it's very metal, very devilish, which brings us into our next topic, not very smoothly.
Great segue.
Religious drama. Woo! We made it. So I guess with my background with religion, my mom never really pushed religion on me, which I was kind of grateful for. We kind of just had rules that were like, this is how you treat people. And that was, our kind of guidepost. But I think some people do need or believe they need a set of rules that are given by a book to in order to be a good person, quote unquote. And it kind of just it's one size fits all. It doesn't fit for everybody. And it kind of creates some really uncomfortable situations. What's been your experience?
Did you hear that deep breath?
I
was raised very religious. And it was deconstructing from that has been a really interesting experience for me. It's been like half my life now.
Sure.
And I'm still working through a lot of it. And a lot of that is due to the fact that like I was not raised by people who said, these are the things that we believe. Mm-hmm. And these are the things that other people believe, any of that. I was basically told that I was given like the blueprint to existence. Like I was told like, these are the things that we believe and this is reality.
Yeah.
Everything else you ever hear from anyone is a lie. And it is the devil trying to deceive you. And so when I started to move away from that, I didn't know how to be a person.
Sure.
Outside of that, I didn't have an understanding of reality or existence or my meaning in any of it. Not that everyone does, but
right.
You know, I,
you didn't even know where to search for.
Right. The rug of the world was pulled out from under me entirely and I was left to figure it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think like a bit something that kind of stands out to me from what you said was just the idea that they delivered beliefs as facts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's like I feel like oftentimes with religion, it's not like this is what we believe. It's this is how it is.
This is the truth. Yeah.
And because of that, like it makes it so that way if you have any ideas or identities or anything that fall outside of that, it becomes very complicated. You have some identities that fall outside of religion? Weird.
Shocker. Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, I have a quick question. What religion was your family?
So very, very Christian.
Uh-huh.
We went to like an evangelical church when I was really young. And then,
can you help me with the definition of evangelical?
So speaking in tongues and like prophesying, and I would have people almost every Sunday, like lay their hands on me and tell me that Jesus was going to make me walk again and all this stuff. And like, then I'd come back to church on Sunday, still in a wheelchair, all that.
Yeah.
And then we left and we went to a, Plymouth Brethren church, which most people have never heard of.
Yeah.
They're very, very, reserved, very conservative. They consider themselves non-denominational. They're not really. But it was very, I describe it as like watered down Baptist with like a dash of like almost like Mennonite vibes. Like if you look at old pictures of like the Plymouth Brethren Church, like they all wore like the same sort of like almost like Mennonite clothing, all of that. Like there's no pastor. There's like a council of elders, which sounds so culty.
Like
it's so wild.
Yeah. Some Skyrim shit.
Yeah. But they would basically have like a public confession every Sunday.
Fuck.
Public.
Public?
Like, yeah. Like we would go an early morning service. I was made to go to the early morning service every Sunday. And they would have two microphones at either end of like the congregation and people would go up and talk about it. You know, sometimes it would be like lighthearted shit. They'd be like, you know, this is what I read in my readings this week. But other times it was like gnarly stuff.
Yeah.
Like there was a person who had been like doing things to children.
Oh, no.
Who like went to prison. Yeah. And when he got out of prison, he was allowed back into the congregation because you don't turn your back on your congregants, et cetera.
Kind of weird for religion because usually they're just like, the second you mess up, you're out of here.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And I don't want to monologue, but the thing that really started to move me away from religion, there was a man who was kind of like a father figure to me growing up. And he worked at my high school, and I was like a teacher's assistant in the library. He was one of the librarians there. And so they would do this thing for these early morning confessions that if it was like the gnarly stuff, they would like send the kids out, and we'd like go upstairs and like all the adults would like talk through whatever the thing was. But when I was old enough to sit in for my first one of these, it was him. And it turns out that he'd been cheating on his wife, with a member of the staff of the school, where I was a teacher's assistant, under him. And so they did this thing, right? But the way that they did this was so strange to me. They like brought him up with his wife in front of everyone.
Fuck.
And I genuinely don't know if his wife knew that this had happened before conversation
video.
Ooh. Right. Cool. And so he, you know, he, the head elder like brought him up and was like, you know, he has something that he wants to confess in front of all of you and in front of God and his wife. And so he says this, and then he turns his back to everyone, like hangs his head in shame. And then the entire congregation starts like clapping for him. And you know, they thank him for his willingness to confess this in front of everyone, and he hugs his wife and hugs the elder, and then that was that, and everything was fine.
Yeah.
You know, and I had this moment where I was like, wow, like all of these people that I thought had these values that they claimed to, like, they're just people, and like none of us really know anything. Like what is, you know, if this person is so, because to my understanding, this man was like so devout and so like close to God and all this stuff. Like if he's like doing this, then like, what am I doing here?
Yeah. Well, and I think like the humanity of it like needs to be brought in, you know, like I think religion, like it works better if we're robots. You know, like if it's just like these are the rules, follow them, you know, and it's just input, output, input, output. It's super easy to like predict how people should function in society. But the problem is that we're all individuals with individual experiences. Mm-hmm. Shit is more complicated than a book that got written that long ago. And it's
translated,
like,
or retranslated and translated and retranslated and rewritten and retranslated.
It's interesting to me how so many people who have religious trauma, like from up, like have so much guilt. But then you see things like that where it's like you can just do something and then just say sorry and it's over, and like no one's gonna hold it over your head. And not that like everybody should have their mistakes held over their head,
right?
But I also think about like like his
why
wife.
Aren't they?
Well, and then the wife too. I was thinking, like, how did she feel about that? Did anybody care about her experience about finding out that she's being cheated on in front of a whole congregation of people?
Yeah.
But they're all clapping for him. Like,
yeah,
I feel like that definitely overlooks like the impact that it has on her, you know.
Exactly.
And like it's impossible
who
to
we
say.
Should care about, right?
I definitely think that like shaming somebody doesn't help them learn from their mistakes very well, but like at a certain point, like the need for accountability and like gentle consideration towards the wife that was affected in that, it was like super important. And it sounds like she didn't get a lot of that. It sounds like it was like, good for you for admitting that, which is like a good first step. But then
they're not clapping for the repair. They're clapping for the admittance of like there being a problem.
You confessed, good. You did the thing. Good.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But like, okay, now what?
Yeah. Right.
Joey, I want to know, like, when did it start to, yeah, I mean, it sounds like that was one of the moments where it started to crack open for you, but is there, like, I mean, I'm curious about that cracking open, like, how that happened, if there's more you'd like to share.
I think, you know, it's funny that we were just, we were, like, talking about philosophy on the break. And so, you know, after that, I was like, okay, well, do I really believe in this? You know, and I was a person who because I was given such a black and white view of the world, I was very dedicated. Mm-hmm. Like the first thing that I wanted to do with my life was be a missionary from childhood. You know, and so I studied the Bible very, very intensely. Like I've read that stupid book, I think 5 times cover to cover, you know, for years. I was in, it's called Awanas. It's like, it's like the Boy Scouts for Jesus kids. you get like merit badges for like memorizing books of the Bible and stuff. Yeah.
Put that on my sash.
And you know, and so I started asking questions, right. Absolutely not, you know, and that was that started to become a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, the minute that I started to express any sort of like doubt or questions, was the minute that relationships started to become strained. And then I, what really did it, because I was absolutely willing to continue to fake it until I figured it out. And then I was outed, by my sister of all people, you know? And so the thing is, you know, you talk about, you were saying something earlier about, you know, being talking about like restoration and how people can make mistakes and repair and all of that. The thing that has always baffled me is the thing that really blew my world up. Was the fact that these people who I had spent my entire life around found out who I love. You know, and religion talks so much about like love and right? acceptance and all of that. And like who I love is what did it, is what ruined it all.
Yeah. That makes sense that you had that falling out with it, because it's just like me at my most authentic and the most happy is upsetting.
Yeah.
Right.
Fucking how?
Right.
Like, if you really cared about me and all the ways that you've said and all of these scriptures and all this shit, like, why is it I fall out of being deserving of love from y'all because of the love that I want to give out and or receive?
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful way to, like, that really has it hit home there.
Yeah, well, and I mean, like, that's, you know, like, I remember, I don't know if I should tell this story. Okay, we can just cut the last couple minutes if it's bad. I'm just kidding. So when I was I think I was in eighth grade, there was this girl that I really liked, and she's like, come to church. And I was like, okay. And it was Mormon church. And I remember one day I came home and I told my mom, I was just like, oh, you know, I started going to this church, you know, to see this person. And she's like, well, you know that if you two get married, that like I can't come to your wedding. And I was just like, I can't believe you think you're invited.
oh my God. That's real though.
No, I would 100% invite my mom, but I mean like it's weird to like, that was where
an
I started. An immediate perspective of like, because my mom is this way, like she's disconnected. She does not have access to all the same things that people who are a different way have access to things.
I think that there's a lot of like, religious values too that have just like seeped into American culture, and that like a lot of like the rules that we're expected to follow, people that aren't even very devout religious, like my grandparents who had like a huge role in raising me, they're religious, but they're not like every Sunday type of religious. They'll go on like Easter and Christmas Eve and shit like that, and a lot of their like they're not cool with gay people. They're not like, they don't hate gay people, but they're like not okay. Like if I had the conversation about me being pansexual, like that would be a whole fucking can of worms that like I have to get through, like my grandma sighing and being like, are you sure? Like it just like it's a whole thing. My grandpa just doesn't give a fuck. He's just like, that's stupid, whatever.
Yeah.
And like the conversation about like trans people is like, I'm not even willing to have that with them. I'm not even willing to hear about
like their thoughts on that. Yeah.
Because they haven't even gotten to the tier where that's like a conversation that's possible to have with them. They haven't accepted base level shit, and like evolving the conversation is just not possible.
Yeah.
And like a lot of that is because of the religious values that even though they're not in like strict attendance, even though they're not in extremely consistent attendance, like that.
They're like, I know the Bible hates these people. I'm with the Bible.
Exactly. And I doubt they'd even reference the Bible like my grandma might, but like I doubt they would even have the conversation from like a religious standpoint, but yeah. They wouldn't realize that a lot of their beliefs are from basic Christianity.
Yeah.
And like that.
Like the impact that religion has had on society. And it's like,
yeah.
Well, yeah.
Religion thinks this is bad, and like I'm not religious, but I like society and the way they think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Therefore, yeah, just, you know, et cetera,
yeah.
Et cetera.
Yeah, like just like we live in a homophobic culture, right? Like, right. Yeah, like that's probably because America was, I mean, part of it. Obviously, there's lots of reasons, but like that America's values are rooted in religion for sure, and like purity and all these ideas. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, and it makes sense why we have all these culturally, like, I don't know, imposed ideas about what's okay and what's not okay, even when we're not religious.
You want to know the funny part? The Bible never actually talks about consensual homosexual relationships.
Really?
If you translate it, if it like the original translations, like the Torah respects 8 different gender identities. And if you go to the proper translations of the earliest writings that are considered to be what is now the Bible, it never actually speaks on consensual, like romantic homosexual relationships ever.
Yeah, well, we know Christians and they like to pick the parts that they identify with and be like, cool, that's the whole thing.
Technically, Christians shouldn't have tattoos or wear fabrics that like
made
like
out of certain things.
Mixed fabrics.
Yeah, mixed fabrics.
That's the thing in the Bible,
yeah.
Too?
Yeah, and that's like,
so
then,
weird.
And if all sins are equal, then it's like, okay, well, you wearing that top with those pants is as bad as homophobia to you. So, or,
And also they don't match. So it's like, yeah, it's also a different sin. All right, well.
You don't have to worry about matching if you wear all black.
Yeah, you got
real.
Right.
Real.
You're goddamn right. All right.
I'm
well,
the only one not wearing all black.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank
I really
you, Joey.
Appreciate
we appreciate you.
Yeah, yeah appreciate
thanks
you.
Thanks for having
thank
me.
Thank you for sharing. Thank you for being vulnerable with us.
Yes.
We appreciate you so much.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that has been The Smoke Break. I have been your host, your old pal Zane, here with Zoe Schwartz, Taylor Barrett.
Hey.
Enjoy, Wanda.
Yellow.
Later, players.